Okay, so we're going to speak about somebody that I assume nobody here heard about, but somebody that occupied an extraordinary moment in history, Adam Gadol B'Yosa, at a nexus of tremendous change, and a lot of what he said, what he did, is still relevant. The person's name was Rabbi Yosef David Zinsheim. He lived from 17... The dates vary, the 28 or 32 or 45 till 1812, mostly in France. And in order to understand a little bit about the person and his extraordinary moment in history, it's going to be important to give a little bit of background. So, because the historical context is extremely important. First of all, whenever you speak about European history, things shift. Two Yosefus remember. First of all, countries were drawn and redrawn and hacked to pieces and reconstituted, and empires. There was a tremendous amount of back and forth. In other words, the same place could be in six different countries back and forth. So the countries are not significant. Provinces are a lot more significant. They tended to be permanent because they were natural configurations, geographic configurations, whereas countries were more what kings put together. Two, the concept of a country was evolutionary pretty much. In other words, the natural groupings, political groupings, was an estate, a puritz, a lodge, a duchy of sorts, and only as history moved on did countries start becoming significant, empires. It was a lot to do, it just was very difficult to manage a big country with what they had in those days. So a lot of times the pritzim of a local place were a lot more strong. Even if they had a king, the king's rule was not so tremendously strong, and the local fiefdoms and the states and pritzim were usually the ones that were stronger most of the time. A lot of times they're the ones that elected a king, but just sort of, it was a balance of power, and they usually had a lot more in the day-to-day power. That's a background. The place we're going to be talking about, where David Zinsheim operated in, was called the two provinces called Alsace and Lorraine. They were, if Germany sits north and east of France. It's sort of France, stretches further south and is further to the west, Germany further east. There are two provinces in the middle called Alsace and Lorraine. They were important provinces because they had later years, especially. They had coal, they had a lot of minerals and stuff like that. And it was like a ping pong between France and Germany back and forth. So they kept bouncing back and forth between Germany and France in the later years. I think at least six times it switched back and forth. So you have German influences and French influences in it. Probably the most famous city for us would be Strasbourg, which is today in France, but the name Strasbourg is German, you can hear it, and it has a Yiddish kehillah to some degree, it had for a long time, and these two provinces kept bouncing back and forth between France and Germany. That's the beginning of the history. The Jews in France had some very good tkufis, and then some bad tkufis, and some terrible tkufis, some horrendous tkufis. From the Crusaders onwards, back and forth, very typical story. France was not yet France, but they kept getting expelled from one end to the other end, and they kept, the king would let them in for 10 years, squeeze them dry, toss them out. Finally, by around 1500, there were no Jews left in France. Period. In what's called France today, there were no Jews left. They would have been finally expelled, and that was it. That stayed for about 150 years. What happened was in the 1600s, about 1618 or so, there was a war called the 30 Years' War. The reason it's called 30 Years' War because it lasts for 30 years. It was quite easy. And it included, as since they were all members of the religion of peace and love, Christianity, so the Catholics and the Protestants killed each other, and the Protestants among themselves killed each other, Catholics, politics, the Pope, the kings. It was one of the messier periods of time in European history. And by the time the war was over, Europe was devastated. Part of that was because the amount of people that were killed in the war, disease, they would burn down cities, farms. So by 1648, everybody was bled dry. And then they had what was called, the Peace of Westphalia, which was a place where they organized different countries, and they solidified a whole bunch of countries, and Alsace-Lorraine passed into France. At this time, France was so bled dry and so devastated, as were other countries, that they very much wanted Jews in. They needed people, they needed commerce, they needed money to borrow, they needed everything. And the Jews began to filter back into France, and it was always xeris that they could live in only certain places, not other places. They couldn't live in the big cities. They could live in the estates. They couldn't live in the estates. They could live in the big cities. It's back and forth, because the central government was not always so strong. But by and large, from 1648, 1650 onwards, they began coming back again. There were Sephardi Jews that came in Anusim, that had come after 1492. In the 1500s, they had sort of filtered into South France. Most of them assimilated, most of them did not stay Jewish. But the Jews that began, Ashkenazi Jews began coming in, and Alsace-Lorraine was a place that was chashuv. In the end of the 1600s, in the 1700s, there were a lot of gzeiros on the Jews. One especially irksome gzeiro was that Jews and cattle had to pay money for passing through a town. So they would, so if somebody passed through, the Jews and the cattle and the cattle paid per head the same price. It was a disgusting, degrading type of tax. It became butler in the late 1700s, but that was life. They had some very chashuv rabbanim in cities in the 1700s. So again, until 1648, 1650, no Jews in France. Slowly it got rebuilt, and such chashuv rabbanim as the Chok Yaakov, Rabbi Yaakov Reisha, the Rabbi Yonasan Eibeschitz was a Rav in Metz, and the Shagasai was a Rav in Metz. These were all rabbanim of world-renowned rabbanim who had rabbanis there. It became established kehillas with a few tens of thousands of Jews, and that's the setting for where we're talking about. Rabbi Yosef Zinsheim was born in that area. He was a big ilui, and we'd see later the svarim that he wrote were incredible. And he married into a very extraordinarily wealthy family. The family was the wealthiest family in the area, and he could sit ala mnucha, and he sat and he learned, he wrote. That was his life. And then he had a yeshiva together. His brother-in-law had established a yeshiva in one of the cities, and he was Rosh Yeshiva there. He had talmidim, and that was his life. In the 1700s, at 1789, the French monarchy came to an end, and you had the French Revolution. French Revolution had two or three different phases. The first phase was a revolution where the people came to sort of an agreement with the government about the king's powers were tempered very much, the powers in the hands of the parliament, and they had all sorts of arrangements, and they also slowly began to free the Jews from all sorts of xeris. It was reasonably, the tide was positive for the Jews, that the Jews would finally, the laws made against the Jews would finally become abolished. And there was a back and forth, that they were still anti-Semites, but the Cholif and the Ruach was much more positive. In 1792, the Jews finally got the right to become citizens of France. In 1793 and 94, there was something called the Reign of Terror. Of the people who made the revolution, there was somebody, the most notable one was called Robespierre, and he was a fanatical liberal, and he was charismatic. He and a few friends of his began, they formed what was called the Committee for the Safety of the State, of the people, safety of the people, everything's for the people, I forgot, it's very important. And they began killing all prisoners, all enemies of the people. There was like, the amount of people that got killed was incredible. Anybody, for whatever reason that they decided, like Russia would do eventually, Russians actually considered him a hero, for good reason. He does definitely embody some of the best qualities that Stalin, you know, he was definitely a worthy of. So the first thing he did was he created this Reign of Terror, and anybody that had money, anybody that was important or significant, he guillotined. And you know, everyone knows about Marie Antoinette and the King and Louis XVI and so on. That was him, Louis XIV. He then moved into high gear, and he really had it in for the Catholics. He despised the Catholics. He felt that they had been together with the monarchy, and that they were oppressive. So he abolished, he closed all houses of all churches. He made them into temples of the mind, of reason, worshiping the mind. And they made no more Shabbos. It was, every month was divided into 3 10-day periods, where, you know, the first day to the 10th, and it was Issachar Chama to celebrate Sundays. He didn't care much, he had nothing against the Jews in particular, but, you know, as sort of a Gilgul Shavua, being that he had to get rid of Catholicism, he tossed the Protestants and Jews also into it. The shuls were possessed, Rabbanim, whichever were nirdaf. If you got caught keeping Shabbos, it was Achas Dos Lahamis, very, very rough time. And at this time, Rabbi Lev Zinsheim had to go away in hiding for 2 years. He ended up in Switzerland, because if they caught you, they were very swift. They were very efficient. From the time of arrest to the guillotine, they didn't wait 24 hours. So it was like, you know, if you got caught and you were a religious figure, it was fanatically religious. He finally made himself the Pope. Robespierre made himself the Pope of this religion, of this non-religious religion. He called himself the High Priest. He came with Big Day Kahuna. Very French imagination the person had. And finally his friends decided, you know, you don't know who's next. They killed him. And that was the end of it. And then it sort of rocked around, very unstable. They had a directorate, they had all sorts of things. Napoleon stepped into that vacuum, and he took over. And at first he was one of the directors, then he finally became the head. He became an emperor, and he set out to conquer the world. He conquered a lot. He came back and reorganized France. The truth be said is that France was pretty, in the overall picture, France did a lot better with him than without him. He put some Seder into France. By and large, his laws were positive. They were what we would call progressive. And he organized everything. And, you know, with all of his, he was a despot. But the things he made were generally good. He also he bled France dry because of all the wars. He tried to conquer the world. He failed in Russia, failed with England. he conquered Eretz Yisrael, but he had to leave because he was stretched too thin, and so on. So Napoleon came in the 1800s, and he decided he's going to deal with the Jews. Now, the Jews were not clear what his real feelings were towards the Jews. Any country that he conquered, his first thing was he emancipated the Jews. He made a law that all laws against Jews are butler mevutel, and so on. Did he really do it to tovus the Jews, or did he do it because he wanted the Jews on his side? Nobody knows. He sent a message that he's going to Eretz Yisrael to liberate it, and he's going to give back the Jews Eretz Yisrael. It's clear that he's doing it to get the Jewish assistant of the Turkish Pasha to be on his side. His name was Farhi, Ibn Farhi, the streets in Gula, on his name. He was like the sort of the commander of Acre and the vice commander. So it seems that that's what he wanted. So when he conquered countries, he instituted that. And that was quite clearly a ploy. But in France itself, he started by freeing the Jews. In other words, all laws that restricted Jews, he canceled. He then backtracked because some of his advisors told him the Jews are terrible. And finally, he called in the Jews and he said, listen, you have a choice. Are you Frenchmen? And then you'll have all the rights of Frenchmen. Or are you a foreign nation? He said, you're not a religion, you're a nation. I can't have another nation living in France. So I need you to show me very clearly that you are part and parcel of the French nation. He called in this group of Jewish notables, and he said, here are 9 questions, or dozen questions, I think, and I need your answer, and I want you to answer truthfully if you're worthy of being Frenchman or be expelled. Now, at this point, 2 things. First of all, Jews didn't have where to go. Expelling a Jew meant there's no place. There was no place to go. One place was worse than the other. There wasn't any place to go. 1. 2. The Haskalah and the reform, I say more, the reform had already cast a shadow on French Jewry. Remember, we said Alsace-Lorraine had been German, so there was a lot of German influence. What the Germans had started to do in the 1700s had instantly infiltrated Alsace-Lorraine, and there was a lot of pro-reform movement. There were not that many Talmid Chachamim. People were not getting any Jewish education. The Chidor we spoke about was there in the 1700s on a tour, on a fundraising trip for Eretz Yisrael, and he complained that there's only one house where he could even meet Milchiks, meet Tzadik Hashras, and none of the kids are getting a Jewish education, and it's really terrible. So the Ruach of the people was already assimilationist, which unfortunately would become the end, what would happen to French Jewry mostly. 2, Napoleon hung a sword over this group. This group answered what they answered, and Rabbi Yosef Dov Zinsheim was amongst that group. He was not happy with, Napoleon was happy with the answers, but he said, that's what the notables, I need the rabbis should give their haskama to this. So in 1806, it's a year later, 1807, he called the Sanhedrin. He made 71 Sanhedrin members, 45 Rabbanim and 26 laymen, and he convened them in a grand hall and called the meeting Sanhedrin. They should discuss this. And if they approve these points, then the Jews can stay in their freedom. If not, Jews will have to go. The one that was elected the head of this, both the first group and the second group, was Rabbi Yosef Dov Zinsheim. He was an extraordinary Talmud Chacham. He was a beautiful speaker. He also had a lot of ideas and worldly things. He was a person that was shayachted. But you're talking about, imagine you're walking on a tightrope. that you, underneath you is a raging fire. There was very, very little room for maneuvering and so on. So I want to read, first of all, a tefillah that he composed. So the opening of the Sanhedrin was an extremely formal event. I mean, it takes French imagination. It was a big palace, and everybody wore robes, and it was grand and solemn, you know, the whole spiel. And he composed a special tefillah. And you note, what's important is to listen to, it had to be schmaltzy, beyond schmaltz, and you also needed to leave some remuzim about what it is that you really think. That's very tough, to be honest and schmaltzy at the same time. It's not an easy accomplishment. So the main complaint, I mean, Napoleon's complaint about the Jews was they're isolationist, they keep to themselves, they see themselves as independent of the government's rule, they do whatever they want to do. And the Ica place where they had the tainus was they charge high interest to the goyim, which is terrible because the Jews themselves don't charge interest to the goyim, they charge interest. That's an enemy to people. Mind you, it was the only profession the Jews had. They were not allowed to own farms, they were not allowed to work. It was one of the most absurd things because, yes, the goyim forced them into it because they weren't allowed to own land, they couldn't farm, they couldn't enter this guild, that guild, the other guild. Come on, the only thing to do was borrow land money, maybe sell third-hand clothing, that was about it. So, but Agaponim, so he has a tefillah. So he starts, Ato Hashem Levadecha, Tasisa Shemayim, Shmei Hashemayim, you know, a whole long fetzi nusach. You brought us to Har Sinai. You gave us the magnificent Torah and taught us what to do. However, with the long years of Golus, of wandering from nation to nation, we have slowly degenerated, and we've started to act in ways that are not so moral. In other words, the faults you find us because of that. And now HaKadosh Baruch Hu did a gewaltig favor with us, and he brought this wondrous noble person who is such a wise man, wiser than wise, our dear King Napoleon. May God Yoram Hoidai V'Yishmoy La'olam Kimorim Kisoy. He opened up his eyes and decided to do good for Klal Yisrael. And he looked into it with his phenomenal Chachma. And he realized that our problems are because of what's happened to us. And therefore, he's decided that he's going to do something for us, something positive for us. He decided to gather us together, 71 people, like the Sanhedrin of yore. And he is the one who appointed us to this great honor. And in order that we have the government's approval, to be able to make this takanas. In other words, he's saying, this ain't no Sanhedrin, this is not Hashem's doing, not doing halacha. It's Napoleon's Sanhedrin, and it's his doing. And then he says, we have a tremendous task in front of us. Give us the koyach, the seichel, the das, not to err, not to go, you know, small, and so on and so forth. And a lot of abakash and tefillah, that they not make any mistakes, which obviously is what he's talking about. Al Kapanim, and everybody was, the French people were extremely inspired from the tefillah, so beautiful and moving, and so such fidelity to the government. I want to read the questions. It's 12 questions, and then I'll read what the answers. One, is it lawful for Jews to have more than one wife? Two, is divorce allowed by the Jewish religion? Is divorce, and this obviously is coming off the heels of Catholicism. Is divorce valid, although pronounced by the courts of justice, but not by the courts of justice, but by virtue of laws in contradiction to the French code? In other words, is a Jewish get chal when the government asks it? Three, may a Jewish marry a Christian? May a Jew marry a Christian woman? Or does Jewish law order that the Jews should only intermarry among themselves? Four, In the eyes of Jews, are Frenchmen not of the Jewish religion considered as brethren or as strangers? 5. What conduct does Jewish law prescribe towards Frenchmen not of Jewish religion? 6. Do the Jews born in France and treated by the laws as French citizens acknowledge France as their country? Are they bound to defend it? Are they bound to obey the laws and follow directions of a civil code? 7. Who elects the rabbis? 8. What kind of police jurisdiction the rabbi exercises over Jews? Are the police jurisdiction of the rabbis in the forms of election regulated by Jewish law, or are they only sanctioned by custom? 10. Are there professions from which the Jews are excluded by the law? That's why there are no Jewish farmers and craftsmen. They never bothered to think that it might be a French law, but whatever. 11. Does Jewish law forbid the Jews to take usury from their brethren? 12. Does it forbid or does it allow usury in dealing with strangers? That were the questions. In other words, basically, are you a different nation or are you Frenchmen and practicing a religion? That's the take of the question. The answers. 1. That after Rabbeinu Gershom's Isser, polygamy is forbidden to Israelites. That's fine. 2. And this is tricky. The divorce by Jewish law is valid only after previous decision of the civil authorities. It's kind of a technical lie, what it's meant is a Jew living in France is bound by French laws. He is not allowed to marry without getting a civil divorce. One must also. So technically, this is true the way he phrased it. In other words, he made it very clear that it's not that the 3. That the religious act of marriage must be preceded by a civil contract. Again, since the Tinah Machusedina, we will not make Git no Ketushin without also having civil. He was willing to go with that, which is fine. 4. Marriage is contracted between Israelites and Christians are binding, although they cannot be celebrated with religious forms. So in other words, we'll call them Mr. and Mrs., but you can't have Sheva Brachas and stuff like that. You can't make a religious wedding. Every Israelite is religiously bound to consider his non-Jewish fellow citizens as brothers and to aid, protect, and love them as though they were co-religionists. Fine. 6. The Israelite is required to consider the land of his birth or adoption as the fatherland and shall love and defend it when called upon. Shalom Malchus. 7. Judaism does not forbid any kind of handicraft or occupation. 8. That it is commendable for Israelites to engage in agriculture, manual labor, and the arts as their ancestors in Israel were wont to do. And finally, Israelites are forbidden to exact usury from Jew or Christian. So, Ribbis. So this is stretching it. In other words, halachically, obviously, that's not correct. I guess he's going with the fact that it's dina machus dina, and therefore you have to comply with laws. It was, like I said before, it was a very, very. I mean, this is one of the most excruciating process, because to say something wrong to Napoleon, besides possibly being killed, but the Jews expelled is a death sentence for tens and tens of thousands of Jews. For the to set something in place that is that would be wrong halachically, absolutely, like only a civil divorce. So these answers are, I guess, the best you can do on diplomacy. He was very, very taken by these answers, and he was fine. He accepted them. They also created the French rabbinate, which is called the consistoire. It's a system of rabbinic. They divided the country into like different sections. Each one has two or three rabbanim and a chief rabbi and so on and so forth. And he became the first chief rabbi. It was because of him that he staved off the reform as much as possible. He couldn't do it totally because the way the government had set up the consistoire, there was a lot of independence in each province. And when a province had shkatzim and that was it, they went more reform. But he did the best that he could. two interesting letters from Napoleon, what he thought about the Jews. So his letter to the Minister of Interior, 29th November 1806, he says, "It is necessary to reduce, if not destroy, the tendency of the Jewish people to practice a very great number of activities that are harmful to civilization and to public order and society in all the countries of the world. It is necessary to stop the harm by preventing it. To prevent it is necessary to change the Jews. Once part of their youth will take their place in our armies, they will cease to have Jewish interests and sentiments. Their interests and sentiments will be French." So one letter of Napoleon is clear that his intention is to get them to assimilate as much as possible. Another letter, a physician had written asking him why he emancipated the Jews. He said, "I wanted to make them leave off usury and become like other men by putting them upon an equality with Catholics, Protestants, and others. I hope to make them become good citizens and conduct themselves like others in the community. As their rabbanim explained to them, as their rabbis explained to them, that they ought not to practice usury to their own brother tribes, but were allowed to do so with Christians and others. And therefore, as I had restored them to all their privileges, they were not permitted to practice usury with me or them, but to treat us as if we were of the tribe of Judah. Besides, I should have drawn great wealth to France, as the Jews are very numerous and would have flocked to a country where they enjoyed so superior privileges. Moreover, I wanted to establish a universal liberty of conscience." So in this letter, he has mixed feelings. He says certain things about them bother him, like taking, lending money with Ribis. Certain things he's doing because he believes in liberal things, and certain things because he's practical. Jews have money, they're successful, and I'm not going to let them go to another country that they'll become better than me. In a private letter to his brother, Jerome, he writes, "I have undertaken to reform the Jews, but I have not endeavored to draw more of them into my realm. Far from that, I have avoided doing anything which could show any esteem for the most despicable of mankind." So, very, very hard to know. Very hard to know if he knew what he wanted. But al kapanim, those were his feeling sentiments. Unfortunately, a lot of what he said became true. The Jews in France, because they got rights, they became very absorbed in the French system, and most of the French Jews assimilated out. Rabbi Dov Zinsheim, while he was embroiled in all this politics and everything else, also had time to learn. Not only have time to learn, he wrote an incredible set of Sfarim that had just recently been published called Yad David. Yad David, what he did was, he said, there are a lot of Sfarim out there, hundreds and hundreds of Sfarim that very few people have. And they have what to add to every Masechta. So he wrote on every Masechta in Shas, all the Sfarim that speak about that Aladaf, that are not Lifi Seder HaMasechta. So Tshuva Sfarim and Stam Sfarim and this and that. And he writes it like modern day Oitzer Mefarshei Talmud. He also has, wherever Tosfos speaks about the sugya and it's not brought in the sugya, he writes it down also. It's an incredible work. Hundreds of Sfarim. We don't even have a lot of those Sfarim today because they were lost, and we have it only through him. Today, this type of work has a staff of 10 people and a budget of a few million dollars to put out. He did it himself. Besides that, he put out on Chumash. He wrote many tshuvas, and he also he has five halakim, we don't have all of them, that they're called the Yad David is on Shas, the Shlal David is on Chumash, and then he has a bunch of Sfarim that go Lefi Seder of Aleph Beis. like about every inyan. I forgot the name now. It's lefi seder inyanim, like aleph beis. It's not a real encyclopedia, but just the shtikel Torah on, you know, ein avir al mitzvahs, on ein this, ein that. It was written lefi that seder. So it's incredible. The Sfarim on Shas is, Mechon Yerushalayim has put it out. It's 15 volumes, covering all of Shas, and an incredible bekias, an awesome bekias in hundreds of Sfarim, and you know, all of it drawn and written out. He wrote Ha'aris to the Nadi Behuda on his Sefer, and the Behuda wrote back with tremendous derecherets to him, you know, like, and then he wrote back to him, and so on. So he was back and forth, writing back and forth to him. That was one. Chassam Sofer was maspid him when after his ptira, and he was an extraordinarily heroic figure, because he had to meet head on the challenge of a tekufa like this, where Jews were being offered rights. They were being offered a chance to live like human beings. The threat was, if not, the situation would get much worse. He had to be able to be diplomatic and try to present things in a way that would sound okay to the king. He had to know where he could make a compromise. You know, halachically, if you could make a takana that you can't get married unless you also have a civil divorce, there's no problem making a takana like that, and that's what he had to do. But not to be mevat on the get, that to him was obviously a gayaver. It took a lot of chachma, a lot of shoulders to take it on him. The Reform tried to later draw on it and saying that the Sanhedrin in Paris was not to this, right? The Sanhedrin was not to that. First of all, that Sanhedrin was no Sanhedrin. One third of it, the laymen, was shkatzim, just plain shkatzim. Amongst the rabbanim, the quote-unquote rabbanim that Napoleon selected, he writes, most of them, you know, knew nothing, and they were not royal to be called rabbanim. He did run the assembly single-handedly, so that, to his credit, that allowed him to get his takanas and so on. But until Mechon Yerushalayim put out his Sfarim, they really, really were, nobody knew about him, Kemat. I mean, people knew, people had heard of Sanhedrin, that was something everybody heard of, the Sanhedrin in Paris that Napoleon convened. But about this person, they had to do a lot of work finding it. His manuscripts were all over. They put it together. It was a big thing, and it's very chashev. It really has, there are Sfarim there that he brings that we do not have today. So this is a person who stood at crossroads of history. It was an incredible tkufa. Napoleon was Kol Yochel at the time. And to be able to negotiate with such diplomacy and fidelity to Torah was an incredible feat. And it's something to remember. His yard site is Zion Kislev. And it's another piece in an extraordinary history of Klal Yisrael. Okay.
His Talmidim from the yeshiva, his brother-in-law, his brother's yeshiva.
Right.
Did it like have a legacy, or just kind of fizzled out?
It fizzled out. There wasn't enough of it to go around. It sort of fizzled out. Mm-hmm. It's called Minchas Ani. The sefer that he wrote, the sefer that he wrote, the Feast of his Minchas Ani. He writes, the reason why he calls it Minchas Ani is because he wrote it when he was in Paris at this thing. He had no sefarim with him, so he really feels very poor, and he's still b'chol zeis, he sat and learned this and that. For having no sefarim, you have to look at that sefer, you know, iron here, and look at this, and he says this over here, and he says this, but you feel that it's answered. It's very, very, I mean, it's incredible. The man had incredible encyclopedic knowledge and extraordinary zikaron. Nothing remained. I mean, that's why that community, in many Jewish histories, is considered to be a non-entity, because they didn't produce anything that really lasted and so on. But they were there. There was there, and there were chashva people there. Shagzaya died in Metz. Shagzaya was, this is where it was. Abishitz moved on to Prague. Others moved on, but. What?
Should we play more music?
Yeah, please.